palms in a very active manner, a surprisingly active manner. Grant began to laugh.
"What is it?" Hammond said, worried. "Is something wrong?"
Grant just shook his head and continued to laugh. He couldn't tell them that what was funny was that he had seen the animal for only a few seconds, but he had already begun to accept it, and to use his observations to answer long-standing questions in the field. He was still laughing as he saw a fifth and a sixth neck crane up above the palm trees. The sauropods watched the people arrive. They reminded Grant of oversized giraffes. They had the same pleasant, rather stupid gaze.
"I take it they're not animatronic," Malcolm said. "They're very lifelike."
"Yes, they certainly are," Hammond said. "Well, they should be, shouldn't they?"
From the distance they heard the trumpeting sound again. First one animal made it, and then the others joined in.
"That's their call," Ed Regis said, "welcoming us to the island."
Grant stood and listened for a moment, entranced.
"You probably want to know what happens next," Hammond was saying, continuing down the path. "We've scheduled a complete tour of the facilities for you, and a trip to see the dinosaurs in the park later this afternoon. I'll be joining you for dinner, and we'll answer any remaining questions you may have then. Now, if you'll go with Mr. Regis..."
The group followed Ed Regis toward the nearest buildings. Over the path, a crude, hand-painted sign read, "Welcome to Jurassic Park." Third iteration. Details emerge more clearly as the fractal curve is redrawn. Ian Malcolm. Jurassic Park. They moved into a green tunnel of overarching palms leading toward the main visitor building. Everywhere, extensive and elaborate planting emphasized the feeling that they were entering a new world, a prehistoric tropical world, and leaving the normal world behind. Ellie said to Grant, "They look pretty good."
"Yes," Grant said.
"I want to see them up close. I want to lift up their toe pads and inspect their claws and feel their skin and open their jaws and have a look at their teeth. Until then, I don't know for sure, but yes, they look good."
"I suppose it changes your field a bit," Malcolm said.
Grant shook his head. "It changes everything," he said. For 150 years, ever since the discovery of gigantic animal bones in Europe, the study of dinosaurs had been an exercise in scientific deduction. Paleontology was essentially detective work, searching for clues in the fossil bones and the trackways of the long-vanished giants. The best paleontologists were the ones who could make the most clever deductions. And all the great disputes of paleontology were carried out in this fashion, including the bitter debate, in which Grant was a key figure, about whether dinosaurs were warm-blooded. Scientists had always classified dinosaurs as reptiles, cold-blooded creatures drawing the heat they needed for life from the environment. A mammal could metabolize food to produce bodily warmth, but a reptile could not. Eventually, a handful of researchers, led chiefly by John Ostrom and Robert Baker at Yale, began to suspect that the concept of sluggish, cold-blooded dinosaurs was inadequate to explain the fossil record. In classic deductive fashion, they drew conclusions from several lines of evidence. First was posture. Lizards and reptiles were bent-legged sprawlers, hugging the ground for warmth. Lizards didn't have the energy to stand on their hind legs.